The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana, bringing Montanans together to learn and reflect for 40 years, and by listeners like you.
Why is Zoe Zindelman called Last Girl?
She is called the Last Girl for two reasons. One is very pragmatic, because this is a very practical and real-world book, and she's the last living girl in her neighborhood because everyone's gone. All the other girls are gone. But she's also called Last Girl because there is a powerful trope in horror and science fiction and horror science fiction, which is the last girl. And the last girl is the one who triumphs. Buffy the Vampire, she's got that last girl going on. That is part of the reason here. So I'm also playing with that trope, but always, 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 it's the truth. Everybody else is like packed up and left that cul-de-sac. So she's the last girl.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman, host and producer of the program. My guest today is Blythe Woolston, and we're talking about her YA science fiction novel, Martians. In that title, the M-A-R-N-T are capitalized. Martians begins with Zoe sitting in Ms. Brody's sexual responsibility class at Wilson Taylor High School. She's calculating that she has another 18 months, or 1,762 and a half hours, until graduation. And Ms. Brody begins to cry, and then this happens.
The giant screen at the front of the classroom brightens alive, full of the looming face of someone we all know and trust. At least in a telepresence way, our governor. Sexual responsibility always starts with the same pre-recorded message reminding us of our pledge to be responsible citizens. My lips start moving around the familiar words, but it's out of sync. This isn't the recorded lesson. The governor's appearing live, in real time, on the education network. Words crawl along the bottom of the screen. Important announcement, important announcement, important announcement, important announce. I don't see Ms. Brody touch the volume control, but suddenly the governor's voice is booming from the speakers. We're all paying attention now, except Ms. Brody, and maybe me a little bit, because I notice Ms. Brody is focused on the wad of tissue she's crushing in her hand. But really, at this point, the message is so loud we can hear it multiplied and mushified as it rings out in every classroom and spills into the halls. It would require discipline and effort not to hear what the governor has to say. Governor. Congratulations, students. Yes, congratulations. I'm pleased to announce that you are all, as of this morning, graduated. My brain does the math. Impossible. This message must be intended for another classroom, another school. We here in 2B have another year and a half before we are fully educated and ready for the future. Governor. In the interest of efficiency, your school, she glances at her phone, Frederick Winslow Taylor High School, is closing permanently as of this date. Each student in attendance will have a personal appointment with the homeroom technician, who will provide an e-certificate of graduation and referral to an appropriate entry-level position. We are extremely proud of all of you on this occasion. Welcome to an exciting future. All students should remember that learning is lifelong, and convenient enrollment in online courses can open new opportunities, including exciting careers in high-demand fields like taser repair specialist and spam dispersal manager. Cut to ad. Voiceover. Unicorn Online University, a better future for you. Scene. Smiling person stares at a phone. Close-up of a screen. Revealing Unicorn University logo. Voiceover. Full of new and exciting possibilities. Scene. Smiling person ascends the steps to gleaming glass building and shows phone with logo to receptionist. close shot of a freshly minted employee badge, followed by a scene of elevator moving upward. Voiceover. All thanks to Unicorn Uni. Go, Unicorn Uni. Ms. Brody grabs the volume control and spins the dial until there's only the faintest fanfare of the music that accompanies the ad. Abernathy, says Miss Brody, and the first of my 2B classmates squeezes between the crowded rows of desks from the back corner to the front. He stands beside Miss Brody's teaching station while she points to her touchscreen. Abernathy checks to see if the content has transferred properly to his phone. When he turns to leave, the door is blocked by a security marshal in black body armor. Abernathy knows the drill. He leans his forehead against the wall and puts his hands behind his back so his wrists can be zip-cuffed together. Even though it's awkward for him, Abernathy flips the whole room the bird as he leaves. His heart isn't in it. He's just doing it because it would be impolite not to say goodbye.
Explain why Abernathy was hauled off by the security marshal.
Well, everybody gets a position that's appropriate to their talents. And they have assessed Abernathy's talents. And he has had, apparently, as well, an internship. He knows how to get zip-cuffed. He knows how to be arrested. This is not the first time for Abernathy. In Zoe's world, everybody gets the job they're suited for. That's Abernathy's. He's a criminal.
So he's shuttled off to prison.
Yeah, or wherever they put people who need to be incarcerated, even if they haven't done anything at the time. I think this is disturbing enough.
They've identified him as a ne'er-do-well, even though he's still a teenager.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, it's like they're going to cut to the chase and put these people where they belong for the rest of their lives.
What opportunity does the governor's plan give to Zoe? This is the most important part.
They have decided that Zoe is best suited for a job in retail at Allmart or Q-Mart. Perhaps this is because of her math skills, which she is proud of, but there may be other more compelling reasons why Zoe goes there instead of any place that might take better advantage of a girl with math skills, like, I don't know, engineering comes to mind. But yeah, that's not her destiny, not in this world.
During an interview with Channel 42, the governor says, quote, "A balanced budget means nothing. I'm not stopping until the budget is zero." Does that mean she's trying to do away with the government entirely while she's the governor?
Yes, that's her project. I'm certain she's not the first person who wants to make the government so small it can be drowned in a bathtub. But yes, that's her plan.
So she closes the schools, sends the teenagers to work at the Mart stores.
Yes, because then they'll be useful.
There are a lot of adults in this book that I didn't like. I didn't like Zoe's mother. She just left.
What I think is key here is that Anna America, Zoe's Anna mom, has been kind of struggling uphill for a long time. She's a single mother, and she became a mother when she was very, very young. And now this whole world is fraying at the edges, and I think she's just desperate. She's fleeing. She knows, as well as anyone else, that what she's doing is not okay, that it's selfish and wrong, but she just pretends that it's completely normal. And we do that kind of often with especially the young. We may not, as parents, abandon them, but the number of people here in this town who don't have a proper place to stay while they're going to high school is distressing in its own right. Whatever those fractures may be in families that tear them apart, certainly economics is a huge one. And while I was thinking about this book and starting to do research on it, I was thinking back on the whole real estate boom and the things that had happened. And some of the more distressing stories that I read were, first of all, that people had no place to put their pets. So they left them in the houses that were forfeit, hoping that someone would come soon enough to get their pets and take them somewhere else, which is a real Hail Mary. The other thing that happened was there were a lot of teenagers who didn't want to necessarily leave their school and friends, and that's not an alien experience for teenagers, or their families couldn't quite have resources to look after all of them now. You know, if they're in a shelter or something, maybe this is just one body too many in the family mix. And the ones who get cut off most quickly are the teens. They're asked to assume a responsibility for looking after themselves more frequently than we care to admit in our economic climate.
When they're not quite ready.
Well, no, and look what kind of an economic climate they're hatching into. I think that is another profound matter. Are we preparing people to have lives in the real world as it exists? I don't know. I can't answer that. I can only know that it's an uphill battle for a lot of people to accomplish.
Before Zoe's mother leaves, she gives her a ride to her interview at Walmart, and then Zoe has to make her way across the freeway to Q-Mart to do that interview. So she leaves her there in this big box store strip with no way to get home and no way to get back and forth to work. So she can't get back home, and it doesn't seem like it's a good idea for her to go home anyway.
All of that is true, and again, you know, to get back to Anna Mom and why she does things, I think denial is a very important factor in a lot of human behaviors. They simply deny that the bad thing's going to happen. Well, certainly she can just take the bus. Well, the fact that the bus doesn't exist is not even investigated, right? It's just, well, of course, the world works this way. She's a mature, intelligent young woman, presuming that there's an infrastructure there that provides things like public transportation. But if that infrastructure is torn to shreds, it certainly doesn't make anybody's life any easier, particularly not a young person just launched into the world.
Yeah, that infrastructure is really crumbling in this story. The satellite rain is happening. Can you explain what that is?
I love the concept of satellite rain. If you imagine now, we're so different than in 1957 when Sputnik was launched. There are so many satellites up there, and most of them are actually rather fragile little things. You know, they don't have to be particularly strong. There's no gale force wind in space, in orbit. But what there is now, and is there's going to be more and more, is like little flecks of space junk, just like what triggered the problem in Gravity. That movie was basically one piece of junk in space hits something that's not quite junk yet, and then it just cascades down. And that idea of a cascade of consequences is really, really important to me, because I think sometimes that first thing that happens doesn't seem particularly significant. And then we wait and we witness more and more things, and we don't often respond until it's catastrophic, until, in this exaggerated case, all of the satellites are now knocking each other out of the sky, and you can look up and see the detritus falling from the sky as shooting stars. But in this world, that's a symbol of how a tiny thing can magnify through time and space until chaos reigns and there's really no going back. Feedback, runaway. You're probably familiar with feedback.
Yes. And we are also very familiar in radio land with the idea that if a satellite moves a hundredth of an inch, you know, all of a sudden we don't have the reception we need. So, yeah, talk to our engineers about about all of that. You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Blythe Woolston about her YA science fiction novel, Martians. You can listen again online to our podcast or at our blog. Links to both are at mtpr.org/twq. You can also get there through our Facebook and Twitter pages. We'll be back in a minute to hear another passage from the book and find out where Blythe Wolston gets her story ideas. Stay with us.
People often call my books near future science fiction because so much of them is simply things that we can recognize now. And part of that is because I'm lazy and I don't want to have to make up like completely different alien species. And then the other part of it is I really don't have much of an imagination. I'm good at exaggerating things.
Yes, your imagination has... has given you four published books.
Yeah, but they're all, you know, if you look at them, you go, well, you know, she's just watching TV.
Well, you definitely don't write cheerful books. Your teenage girl protagonists tend to be dealing with awful parents and or really challenging life situations. But you write very creatively, and I really like the scenes with the TV reporters reporting the satellite rain and the governor and kind of jabbing each other while they're at it.
Yeah, there's a whole nother play in this book, a whole nother book, I guess. And I think that that's an aspect of how I actually envision the world, is I envision how does a person get their information. Well, a person in the near future is going to get it mostly from Channel 42, I'm afraid.
The metaphorical TV channel of the world in your book.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So do you remember how the idea for this book arrived in your brain?
Oh, geez. There are a few things that are, of course, always brewing. But one of the most early experiences was being in the Nevada desert and seeing a housing district that had been planned. And I think it was like several hundred miles away from any place. It was not far away from like the highway called the Lonesomest Highway. But here was this place out in the desert where there were like gravel streets and the signposts for the streets were all there. But the rest of it was like there were no houses at all. And then we drove farther, and we actually found some places where there would like be those elaborate gates to a housing development area or a community, whatever. And maybe past it, there would be, again, streets and street signs, imagined amenities, and no houses or foundation and a started house. This was another aspect of the housing boom and collapse that happened, was there were a lot of things that were in process that were never quite finished and have now, I assume, either gone completely derelict or maybe they were picked up again, or maybe they're full of coyotes. That's different than being derelict, I guess. That's being good use.
Yes, there were several fairly deserted housing developments in your story. They had houses on them, but tell us what was happening to those houses.
Oh, like the houses, her neighbor's houses, for example, on the cul-de-sac? Well, as she points out, that her neighbors have left and they don't take care of the place anymore. They don't even shut the door to keep the raccoons out. But the raccoons, frankly, are the least of our problems. There are valuable things in abandoned houses, things that can be sold to scrapyards, like copper wiring. And you can rip that out. Plumbing, rip that out. You can basically take the good stuff and leave everything that doesn't matter behind. And that's not imaginary.
After Zoe's Allmart training ends, her first day of work arrives, and I'd like you to read that passage, but explain why Zoe's employee badge says zero.
Oh, well, you know what happens here. When you're really part of a huge, huge corporate community, it's important that we all maintain a distinct individual identity so they can track our performance. So if there's another Zoe, then that's a terrible situation. So Zoe can't be Zoe. She has to be something else. So she becomes zero. Mortimer, the boy who saves her, who would really rather be Tim, he's Mort. Okay? There's a relationship between Zoe and Mort in the book that I think is important because of their name badges. I'm sorry. There's just a lot of Easter eggy stuff that I put in this book just to make myself happy.
Oh, like, I know.
Adventure towels.
It's so much fun.
Sorry. It's just like, oh, sure. Anyhow, those name badges function primarily to serve the corporation. What they also do, though, is they take your identity away. When somebody walks up to you and says, you are no longer Bella, you're Belly.
She really fought that one.
She did fight that one. Good for her, because that's a terrible thing. And other people have names like Drain and Soapy.
You had fun with those.
I did. I'm so kind of ashamed of how much fun I had with the names. But that's a huge thing. Your name and your identity, you should get to define that for yourself. You really should. Okay.
All right. Chapter 10.
It's a big day today. Today I graduated from classroom training to actual work on the store floor. I'm teamed with a supervisor and an experienced associate to ensure my success. When I scan my tag, my phone trembles, and I get my assignment. 2-0 from Donna Day, Human Resources. Work assignment 1. Joy Zone! Happiness is always on sale at Joy Zone. Directions. Proceed to Joy Zone prep area. Select costume. Note location of related products. Watch product vid. Panic flutters against my ribs. I don't know the way to Joy Zone prep area. I'm going to be late because I'm going to be lost. Then my phone trembles. When I look, the tiny screen text says, take the corridor to your right. Proceed through inventory stacks 37 to 46. Turn right at inventory stack 46. The prep area is on your left, beside the doors marked store floor. Now I need to choose a costume. My choices are a duck bill, an elf hat, or a floor-length sparkle power fairy pony tail hair extension. Each of them comes with appropriate booties that slip over my shoes. The best choice for me is that glittery hair attachment and the high-heeled hooves that go with it. The hooves would be impossible to walk in if they were real shoes, but as flexible plastic illusions, they work. I check to make sure I know where these fine products are. Fairy ponytail toys, including sky hooves, can be found on aisle 49. I will not, however, be working in that aisle. I head for aisle 46, where I am to rendezvous with my co-workers. The air in Joy Zone smells heavily of plastic. The toys are off-gassing. I suppose people with children, and children themselves, are indifferent to stink. The supervisor of Joy Zone is waiting, wearing a smile as big as a welcome mat and a pair of fleecy animal ears. She waves at me. Her ears waggle back and forth. Thought-controlled. She brushes her hair up so I can see the silvery electrode attached to her forehead. Found in electronics, not toys. Boo. Her giant smile becomes a pout, which is over and done in less than 3 seconds. Then she touches her name tag and says proudly, I'm Dolly, Dolly Lamb. My other co-worker for the day approaches. The duck snout and rubbery yellow booties don't disguise the walk. I know that walk. It's Timmer. It's the first time I've seen him at work. Dolly Lamb bustles past me and throws her arms around him. It's my favorite Mort in the whole wide world. She pulls his face down to her level and plants a big smacking kiss on the duck mask. Then she turns to me and squints at my badge. Zero? Zero! It's your first time here, right? Yes, ma'am. Don't ma'am me. I'm Dolly Lamb. We're all kids here, Zero, and you look adorable. Today is dinosaur day. She points at a giant acrylic bin. Inside it is a tangle of plastic animals, all different shapes and sizes. Outside, sticky smears left by little hands and noses. We need to destock these dinos. First, we sort all of these items into inventory buckets. Then, we'll install the new display brackets. Dolly pauses and squeezes Timber's biceps. We are so lucky to have these big muscles to help us. Dolly seems a little lost in the moment. Her thought-controlled ears tremble. Then we stock the space with DinoRoar Twin Packs. You watched the product vid, right? Yeah, of course you did. I hear such nice things about you, Zero. She smiles. I smile. Our smiles duel. The biggest grin wins. My cheeks hurt. She wins. Thank you, Dolly Lamb, I say. I wonder about what she might have heard, and I also wonder why it's so hard for her to read my name tag if she was expecting me. But those thoughts aren't happy thoughts. Those thoughts don't belong in Joy Zone.
Tell me what else you want to say about the book.
I'd like to say that it's terrifically hard to make a case for buying a book that's about consumption and commercialism. But I know for a fact that it is in some libraries. And if you request it from a library, they'll probably be able to get it for you.
Well, I'd like to make a case for buying the book anyway, because it's very entertaining and it's satire. It's really satire on consumption. So
it is satire. I know there's a lot of chat back and forth about, you know, what should this be called? And a lot of people choose to call it dystopia. And that's not really a bad thing, because when I first started pitching this book to people, I called it Animal Farm with People. And it's that old school kind of dystopia that's really involved here. I love it that it's actually being read as what it is, which is satire and not just another girl saves the world story, because really that is not what's happening here. Not a triumphant hero quest against the great dystopia. No, I can't write that one.
Blythe Woolston lives in Billings, Montana. More information about her is available at our blog. Look for the link to it at mtpr.org/twq. Also there, you'll find poems and children's book reviews, as well as links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridas. The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.